Hey, Julian.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing good. What are we going to talk about today?
Turmeric.
Ethnopharmacologicals.
Yeah, that's what I said. Turmeric, yeah. And valeria.
Okay. Tell you what, let's get Professor Tony Booker on.
Brilliant.
Hi, I'm Mike Brampton.
And my name is Julian Ho.
Welcome to Veterinary Ramblings.
So you were saying, Julian, that this guy, Tony... So this is the guy that goes sailing and stuff with you?
That's it. That's it. Yeah, he's here. He's here, Mike. He's here. Right.
But you call him Dr. Professor Hare.
Hare Professor Dr. Tony.
Hello, Tony. I was just discussing life with Julian.
Sure. Good stuff.
Right, okay. So everything that you're telling me tells me that you should be referred to as Professor Tony Booker. Is this right?
I'm not a professor, no. Although I'm going to get I'm going to become associate professor of China Medical University in Taiwan very shortly.
Wow!
Yeah, means I have to go out to Taiwan and do a bit of teaching, which is okay.
Excellent.
I like Taiwan.
How fabulous!
But you've been to China and Japan quite extensively, haven't you, Tony?
But China, yes, big place. Yeah, spent a lot of time there. Yeah, China, Taiwan, Japan. India, especially. Yeah, spent 6 months in wandering around India, looking for turmeric plants and stuff like that.
And this was for your PhD, wasn't it?
Yeah, so the field work in India was the part of my PhD. Yeah.
Tony, you're telling me that you've got a PhD in turmeric.
Yeah.
You don't need to study for years and years and years. You just go to Tesco's, or other supermarkets are available, aren't they, Julian?
They are.
Apparently so.
So you could go to Sainsbury's or Waitrose or Morrison's or Asda.
Yeah. Well, Morrison's. Funny you should say that. Part of my PhD actually involved going to Morrison's and buying some turmeric, which then I took home and analysed by a nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy and thin layer chromatography. And the Morrison's stuff, it was very nice.
Right. So okay. I want to backtrack here.
Okay.
Right. So I've just said you can go to wherever, and you just told me that for your PhD you had to go to Morrison's.
Yes.
So tell me more about that.
Well, I was interested in collecting samples of turmeric. So
right.
I didn't go to Morrison's first. First, I went to India.
Right.
I went to Tamil Nadu and Karnataka and somewhere near Delhi.
Right.
And collected different samples of turmeric.
Right.
Either fresh or dried samples. And then I also collected samples from the internet and from health food shops.
Did you have to go onto the dark web to get turmeric on the internet?
I didn't, no.
All right, okay.
I stayed on the light web.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah. So,
But I wanted to compare against fresh turmeric, and the best place that I found to get fresh turmeric was in Morrison's. It was sprayed with some nice water to keep it nice and moist. I took it and dried it. My mushroom dryer, and then ground it, and it was quite interesting because it actually contained. I found it contains compounds that were actually absent in all the powdered turmeric, which is probably the compound I should have actually investigated from a PhD because that would have been really interesting. But
right.
It seems to disappear really, really quickly on drying, so perhaps it's not very stable, but there's certainly something in fresh turmeric that's not in in the dried form.
So you were looking at all sorts of turmeric, all presentations, and what you found was that fresh turmeric, and I wouldn't even know what fresh turmeric looked like,
has
got compounds that are not found in the dried turmeric that we buy in the little bottles.
Exactly, yeah. So that was part of it. And But kind of attached to that, what my kind of hypothesis was that it linked into value chains. And the hypothesis was that if you made a direct contract with farmers in India, what's known as a vertically integrated value chain.
Right, so this is a value supply chain, is it?
Yeah. So the value chain is similar to supply chain, but it's just with the added idea that as you move through different stages, you can add value to a product, either things like it being organic or being shown to have certain qualities. So it's often described as value chain in kind of more modern literature. Right. And so I was trying to show that it not only had benefits for the livelihoods of farmers in India, but it also actually increased the quality of the actual product.
Right.
And so I compared a product that had been in this vertically integrated value chain with turmeric that's actually bought through the normal route, which is by auction. Now, the problem with auction is turmeric prices are very volatile. So sometimes, you know, if they go up in price, all the farmers start planting because the turmeric's very good and it's a good way to make money. But what happens is that because all the farmers start planting, they overproduce. So the next year, the price goes down.
Yep.
And when it goes down, no one wants to sell it. So what they do is they store it. And they can store it for something that I didn't know. And the only way I could possibly find out was actually going out to India and look. They can store it for kind of 3, even up to 5 years.
Wow.
So when you get the turmeric on the shelves in the supermarket and it's got an expiry date on, you could add 5 years onto that where it's been in stored before it's actually been sold. And because it's in places like India, when they store it, they have to protect it from molds and insects and all this kind of thing. And the only way they can protect it is by the heavy use of pesticides and fungicides and that kind of thing.
Right.
So,
Does that affect the quality of the product directly?
Well, one, it increases the kind of loadings of things that you don't really want, i.e. pesticides and fungicides, but also as it's stored. So this was like the crux of what I found in my PhD. You lose all the volatile components. Mm. And what I was able to show that one, if you bought very fresh turmeric, it had so many compounds in it. If you bought the turmeric that was widely available in health food shops and on the internet, it may well contain curcuminoids, which is the main ingredient, but most of the volatiles were gone because it was old. But I was able to show that the product that was obtained through the vertically integrated value chain, i.e. this product that was produced by Packer, actually contained a very important compound tumerone, which has been shown to have anti-inflammatory action. And it was only the Morrison's fresh turmeric and the Packer dried turmeric vertically integrated value chain product that contained this compound. And that was the first time that this was ever shown. And that was the novelty of my PhD.
So what you're actually saying then, and correct me if I get this wrong, is that whilst turmeric is often used for its anti-inflammatory effects, aside from, if we're looking at medicinal effects, from the flavours and the cooking flavours that you get, a lot of people take turmeric for anti-inflammatory effects for things like arthritis and sore joints, etc. Quite controversially here, what you're actually saying is that a lot of the dried turmeric that is sold for that purpose actually contains no active ingredients or vastly reduced ingredients.
Yeah, certainly vastly reduced. And With the anti-inflammatory action, everyone focuses on curcumin,
right,
which is regarded as the main active ingredient, which isn't particularly volatile. And so even in older samples, you can find curcumin and curcuminoids. But it's not such a simple picture. There's actually hundreds of different compounds in turmeric, all which may be playing their part, also may have synergistic actions. But certain compounds, i.e. turmerone, have actually been shown to have anti-inflammatory action. And also there's a Japanese turmeric that doesn't contain any curcuminoids, which has also been shown to have anti-inflammatory action. And that contains, probably because of some of the polysaccharides that contains. So everyone focuses on the curcumin, but it's not necessarily the curcumin that produces the results. And curcumin, the other thing is curcumin is really poorly absorbed. It's not very bioavailable. So it doesn't explain why turmeric should have any anti-inflammatory action.
In a way, that would explain why the fresher samples are perhaps more effective, because the volatiles are more likely then to have an anti-inflammatory effect. Is that right? So the fresher sample, the more likely they are to have an anti-inflammatory effect. Or am I being a little bit simplistic there?
Yeah, possibly, yeah, and some of the volatiles have been shown in vitro and in vivo tests to have some anti-inflammatory effects.
Mm.
Okay, so you're holding up there, Julian. You're holding up what looks like a ginger root.
Yeah, it looks very much like a ginger root. It's rather more reddish
than a ginger root. It's more slender. That's just reflecting off your T-shirt, which is also red.
Yeah.
So this is a turmeric root.
Did you grow that?
And I grew this.
Wow, it's really good.
So we've got a good harvest.
Doesn't grow well in the UK.
Yeah, but it grows well on my tortoise enclosure. There we go.
Mm.
That's what I got. And the good thing is, so I've collected these and kept them in a paper bag, and they're starting to shoot. And so I'm going to plant these again and hopefully get another lot. But what I haven't been able to do in this country is to get turmeric to flower.
Wow, it's a lovely flower.
It's a beautiful flower. I bought a turmeric plant that was flowering, but that didn't produce much in the way of root. But my turmerics, which are perennial, or rather an annual, isn't it? They come up every year from the root.
Yeah.
They've never actually flowered.
So what do you grow this for then, Julian?
Primarily for food, right. So as a flavouring, but with the hope and expectation that having lots of turmeric in my diet will help my ageing joints.
Right.
And it seems to work. It hasn't helped my hair, but it's...
What hair?
Absolutely. I'm still hoping. But it does taste nice as well, doesn't it, turmeric?
Good stuff. Turmeric you're eating.
Turmeric tea doesn't taste nice, though. Tony tried to get me to drink turmeric tea once, and I've tried it a few different brands a few times, and I can't really get into it.
Yeah, turmeric latte is not so bad.
Turmeric latte. So what got you into all this, Tony? Let's zip back a few years. So we've got a PhD in turmeric.
I got a PhD at 50, and I thought, 50 years out, I was 50, and I noticed that everyone else seemed to be a lot younger. I was one of the oldies.
Mm.
I only actually intended to do a 1-year MSc at the UCL School of Pharmacy, because originally I started out in the Wellcome Foundation as a chemist. I lasted about 12 years in the pharmaceutical industry before I decided a regular job wasn't for me.
And this was manufacturing Western drugs, essentially, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. But strangely, I was not by choice. I just happened to be involved with natural products. So we made digoxin from Digitalis leaf, foxglove, and we made tubo curarin, which was some curare leaf. So we used to import the curare from South America, and ephedrine we made, and insulin. So I made lots of different natural products, and that's why I was involved more in the testing, quality testing of these, and also partly in their manufacture.
I'm rather interested in the curare.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, tell me about your work in Curare. The reason I'm interested in that is I'm interested in anaesthesia.
All right, okay, yeah. So, I've probably forgotten more than I know about it. It's something we teach to the students in the MSc in pharmacognosy course at UCL.
What, chew this leaf for 10 minutes?
Yeah, well, chewing it, that's one of the strange things. You can chew it and it probably wouldn't do you much harm. But if you had a slight cut, so in the factory, it all used to be, quite out in the open and no one was too worried. But if you had any kind of cut and you got it into that, then there'd be a problem.
I think possibly we should actually just quickly say here, because it's all very well me glibly saying that I'm into anaesthesia. For listeners who may not be aware, and again, correct me if I'm wrong here, Tony, we could glibly say that curare is a paralyzing agent. Or would you describe it as something different?
Yeah, well, you could say that. I mean, its traditional use is, as most people know, or many people know, it's used on the tips of darts, and why it's used is because it doesn't kill the prey, but it paralyzes it, so the meat actually stays fresh over years, or not years, over days or weeks when they're traveling through the jungle. And this is one of the first kind of
blow this myth apart for me, please do, because I thought that they put it on tips of darts to enable them to bring down prey like monkeys or whatever. So because obviously they're up in the trees, dangerous to go up and get the prey if it was gutted and killed. Prey falls out of tree, they capture prey, kill it and eat it.
They capture prey, but don't necessarily kill it.
Don't necessarily kill it, no. And, they might kill it and eat it at the time.
Right.
But if they don't choose to eat it, then it will stay, alive but paralysed for some time.
Right.
Yeah. And this is one of the first kind of ethnobotanical, ethnopharmacological studies. Or one of the really major ones. I mean, the other one being, I mean, the first one was actually with serpine, which is, I'll just digress for a sec, because that's a really interesting part, which was with elephants.
Right.
Which, yes. Serpine was the very first pharmaceutical drug for high blood pressure.
Right.
Again, in India, someone was watching elephants, and they saw them eating this plant called Rauwolfia, and they noticed that the elephants would become, after they ate the plant, they'd become very relaxed and sedated and very calm. And so the plant was collected. Nowadays we call it biopiracy. It was taken from India, and there was no kind of recompense given to the local people and people with the knowledge of any medicine. But anyway, that's how it used to happen. And reserpine was eventually developed, and it was the first, as I say, the first drug to treat high blood pressure.
Right. And, is that in humans or across the board?
In humans.
It was in humans. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Wasn't it used as an antidepressant as well?
It may have been, yeah. I don't know. It may have been terpene, because it certainly had some sedative effect.
Mm.
So that was one good example of ethnobotanical research and ethnopharmacological development. But then curare was another one, because we knew that it paralyzed animals. And so the idea was, well, this will stop muscle. This obviously stops muscle movement. Yeah. And the idea was how, well, perhaps this would be useful. One of the big problems in surgery is, you know, things moving around. After some development, to make a long story shorter, it was developed into one of the first drugs to use in things like open heart surgery, and the drug tubocurarin was produced, which by Wellcome went way through into the 1980s, 90s. Eventually, it was superseded by the synthetic drug atricurium.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it did a very good job for a long time as to be used as in surgery.
And you use this term a couple of times, ethnobotanical pharmacology.
Yeah,
and that's and you mentioned ethnobotanical piracy, was it as well? And is that essentially seeing what certain ethnic or Aboriginal peoples use and then trying to find a scientific rationale for it and subverting that to big pharma.
So ethnobotany, the use of plants by humans, ethnopharmacology, the development of drugs that are based on traditional use by people. I mean, if we go back into the 1950s, 1960s, it was deemed quite acceptable to go out to Africa, South America, find plants, bring them back, turn them into drugs, make lots of money. Since then, you know, times change. We now have the Rio Convention on Biodiversity and the Nagoya Protocol, which actually protects indigenous people. So it protects indigenous knowledge. We hear about intellectual property, but what was often forgotten is, you know, even if you're a small tribe living in the middle of the Amazon, you still have intellectual property. You know, your knowledge of how a plant may be used to treat a certain disease is actually very important. And someone to go in and take that knowledge and take it to the other side of the world and then make millions from that. And for you, who actually had the information to begin with that actually enabled that to happen, to not profit at all from it, is actually ethically and morally wrong. So now there's conventions like the Rio Convention and the Nagoya Protocol that actually tries to protect the rights of
when did that
indigenous
happen?
Groups.
When did that happen, Tony?
Not until the 1990s. These things come in, so quite late. Really.
Right. And they're not retrospectively applied. So these
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
So these are things like the Nagoya Protocol, Rio Convention. They're absolutely great. They're actually what should have happened. But the negative side, they've it's totally stopped any interest in pharmaceutical companies wanting to do research into plants.
Yeah. Because it costs them more money.
It costs them more money. It's the, yeah, it's, you know, they, the involvement, the kind of red tape and bureaucracy. Yeah. So there's a, and so because they don't want to get involved, it's got a kind of more of a negative effect as well. So,
yeah, so do they, interesting scenario. Do they not do it on the quiet then? Do they not think, oh, we've got XYZ going on, let's quietly investigate it and synthesize a synthetic equivalent?
It's difficult to do it on the quiet because whenever you you need, before you get onto clinical trials, first of all, you need to publish your first in vitro sort of data. And then whoever's doing the peer review wants to know, you know, one of the questions you're going to be asked is, you know, where were the plants where did they come from? Where did you source them? What was your relationship with the, you know, did you abide by the, Rio Convention? This is, you know, so it's very difficult to make that happen.
It's interesting that, because I think I've come across this myself personally. Although I don't know the story of behind it, but many years ago I was working in a clinic in Malawi, in Africa.
Yeah.
And that was an HIV malaria clinic.
Yeah.
And all of the Western doctors and medics and nurses, all of us were trying to take prophylactic malaria treatments, whatever that may be. Now, that most of the Western prophylactic treatments for malaria are not very pleasant on the side effects. There's three main ones. But I was taking Artemisia tea, which I had been given from a friend in Zimbabwe. So it was reasonably local to the area, because I understand that's quite important, that you derive the plant in the area where you're likely to get the infection from. I stopped taking it for a couple of weeks. I think I got bored of having tea every day.
Yeah.
And contracted malaria.
Right.
So I was given the pharmaceutical grade of Artemisia, dose Artemisia, 3 days, back on my feet, carry on as normal, Brampton. Let's go.
Yeah.
So do you know anything about the story about Artemisia and the malaria treatment stuff then, Tony? Is that...
Yeah, well, I mean, artemisinin, the pharmaceutical drug, is one of the sort of latest and probably the greatest success stories of ethnopharmacology and research. Right. And actually, Yu Tao, who did the work, actually got the Nobel Prize for her work on artemisia.
Oh wow!
And she literally dedicated her life. She didn't see her children for like 20 years, and you know, she was like stuck in a lab somewhere in China, just working on this project. And it's become, you know, it's saved literally millions of lives in sub-Saharan Africa. All coming from this natural product, artemisia.
Right.
So artemisia was very was known as being known as Qinghao in China, was known to be something that could reduce fever.
And you were saying the Chinese have written records going back 2,000 years.
Chinese medical texts going back to 2,000 years. Some of the, you know, major texts that are still taught in universities are, you know, looking at AD 200. Famous Chinese scholar physicians were writing texts then that are still followed today.
Wow,
we might pick up on later. But this particular herb, artemisia, was studied by scientists. So there's lots of bioprospecting, as we call it, you know, analyzing. You know, this is what lots of universities do: look at activities of different herbs, different medicinal plants. And for a long time, this plant was looked at and it showed no real activity against malaria, which was one of the interests that the people had. But then the kind of anthropologists started to get involved and started really interrogating the old Chinese texts. And through this careful interrogation, they found that it wasn't actually an extract that, that was used 2,000 years ago. Or how they were using the plant, they was actually squeezing the juice from the fresh plant,
right,
and taking that, which is actually quite unusual in Chinese medicine, because most of Chinese medicine is taken as a decoction, an aqueous decoction, where herbs are just cooked up in water and drunk. But this was unusual, and through the text they found it was squeezed. The fresh plant was squeezed, and the juice was drunk, and so. This was followed in the lab, the squeeze, and they found that there was an activity there against the malaria plasmodium parasite.
Sure, because previously they just looked at the activity of dried leaves as they would do normally, made into an infusion, and found that didn't work. So they concluded it was bunkum.
Yeah. And this Yu Tao took this up and found there was an activity, but then she also was a very good medicinal chemist and slightly changed, as medicinal chemists do, changed some of the functional groups and turned it into artemisinin, and it became the most effective treatment against malaria that we know. The only downside is it's got quite a short half-life. And so it won't, you've got four stages of malaria parasite. It won't, you can't address all four. But if you use it with a more well-known, longer-lasting, like one of the chloroquinines or something like this, you absolutely have to use the two together, and then you get very, very good results.
Right. And
interesting.
Like, I understand there's no sign of resistance to it after all these.
Yeah, no, because the way the compound works, it's got a very, I think it's got a very reactive oxygen molecule in there that literally blasts the parasite. So it's very destructive, and it's very difficult to build up a resistance against that.
Especially to a drug with a very short half-life, because it's not only got to survive to create progeny that produce a resistant species, subspecies, or cerevar, but it's also got to do that within a very limited period of time, hasn't it? So,
yeah,
amazing. But
I'll vouch for the effectiveness. It's incredibly effective.
Yeah. You had it, Mike. You had malaria.
I've had malaria. Yeah.
And you took this as a tea or as the
I was given they sell it as it's sold throughout sub-Saharan Africa as a sort of a 3-day pack, and you have to take your full dose. It's like antibiotics, and when it says take two of these now, and then 6 hours later take four of these, and 6 hours later take two of these. That's what you do. You basically take this whole medicinal course, except rather than it being in sort of a powdered form or as leaves or anything like that, it's as proper Western pharmaceuticals. You know, take tablet A now and take tablet B in 6 hours' time. But it is incredibly effective. And it was what we used at the clinic anyway. I just didn't expect to be on the receiving end of it. The onset of malaria is rapid. 1 hour you'll be absolutely fine. An hour later you'll be in hot, feverish sweats but feeling cold, and it just develops from there. It's incredibly rapid, and so probably within about 4 or 5 hours of contracting the fever, I was being given artemisia. And you know that your first night is going to be rough. and you've got the whole hallucinatory thing going on from high fever and high temperature. But you keep taking the course, even if you feel sick and you don't want to eat it or drink anything, you keep taking it. And 3 days later, I was hitchhiking over to Zambia because my visa had run out. So, you know, it was from death's door, feeling like death, with green frogs crawling out of my bed to eat me, to hitchhiking into darkest Zambia.
So, and of course, none of the Nagoya Protocol or Rio Convention actually applied here, because everything was in-house within China, and so everything went by Chinese rules rather than sort of global rules.
Interesting.
Yeah.
and so the people who actually produced this tea for many centuries, many millennia, now can't afford to use it.
Well, presumably, because the guys that grow the crops, most of the crops are taken by the large pharmaceutical companies.
So it's mainly, I mean, they still, I mean, China has invest a lot in Africa and a lot of Chinese medicine is very much used in Africa, and the Chinese have a lot of investment there because the Chinese government are interested in African resources, in particular their mineral resources and things like copper and iron, and all things that help to build circuit boards in China. And so there's a very strong interest in Africa. So they work. There's a lot of work that they do together. That's probably getting a little bit more into the politics.
Let's deal with some aspects of China here. Tony, you just tripped off Qing Hao. You tripped this off as if this was a lingua franca for you. This is common language for you.
Yeah.
You've also talked a little bit there about Chinese medicine. So you've done a lot of work in the ethno-herbalism. We've talked about artemisia, malaria, et cetera, et cetera. So Chinese medicine. Here's one for you. Well,
yeah.
I mean, it's not really a question, is it, Julian? I was going to say Chinese medicine, hoodoo, voodoo, or what? But I think Tony's already answered this. It's a genuine thing that we should be paying attention to.
I guess he kind of has, and there's a bit of preamble to this, isn't there? Because we call it veterinary ramblings, and we're constantly banging on about evidence-based medicine in the veterinary field at the moment.
But this guy's got a PhD in turmeric.
And he must know what he's talking about. So what's going on? There's a disconnect somewhere, isn't there?
Yeah.
Where is the reconnect? What can we do?
I think what you're getting towards is, we've got people like Professor David Calhoun, who's very, and Ben Goldacre, who wrote Bad Science and Bad Pharma, were very much anti any kind of alternative medicine. To be fair, they're very anti. David Calhoun is also, he's at UCL. He's an emeritus professor now, who's retired. He's also anti a lot of Western medicine, and because he said it doesn't work. So, to be fair, he's just sort of anti anything that doesn't have a good kind of p value,
or anything with n equals one.
Yes, exactly. But I think he would agree that artemisinin, for instance, there's no problem at all with that, because it's a drug that's gone through clinical trials. It's been proved to be effective, as is digoxin, is a very effective drug for treating angina. Would you want to take leaves off of a foxglove plant, boil them up and drink it? Probably not.
Not really.
But we got some foxgloves out of the heart problem.
Yeah, it did happen. So I think people in this camp, you've got the Nightingale group, are just calling for more evidence. The problem is that the funding isn't out there.
Yeah, evidence costs money, doesn't it?
Yeah, so this is one of the things I'm really involved with is research. Perhaps we get onto that a bit later. We need more research into this area. So I think the disconnect you're talking about is that, you know, people are very happy. You know, drugs are drugs. It doesn't matter if they're synthetic drugs or they've been produced from natural origin, whether that origin is bacteria or plants. Once they get to that point, they're a single active compound. And it's a drug. Mm. It goes through the normal clinical trials and approved by the FDA or MHRA. But it's everything before that. Once we start talking about a herbal medicine, then it becomes in a different camp because the evidence isn't there.
And you're not just talking about one compound, are you, often with herbal medicines? You may be talking about many hundreds of different compounds in one medicinal package.
Yeah, absolutely. Most of the time, the actual compound is like with turmeric, people focus on the curcuminoids. You know, there's many other compounds in there as well. And people try extracting just the curcumin and they may sell this as product. But again, the research and the evidence, isn't great.
Yeah. And yet it's very difficult, primarily doing clinical trials, even if you were given all the money, very difficult doing clinical trials on multi-pharmacy, isn't it, polypharmacy, looking at the effects that maybe 100 compounds in one particular drug.
Yeah. I mean, you can do the clinical trial, but the difficult part is showing the mechanism.
Which is what
Regulators want in order to give something a full marketing authorization or a product license.
Yes.
They want to know, the mechanism involved. And
they do, but also the in the clinical trial itself, with a leaf, do you have exactly the same ratio of all the compounds per leaf?
Well, that is another problem to stand. What you can do is you can standardize a herbal product to a particular active ingredient.
Yes.
They do, high pterosine and St. John's work. But again, you don't know if that's the main ingredient. All you can really do is take a large sample of a particular plant and analyze the samples and then pick one that seems to be an average of all the samples. But the only problem with that is an outlier or a plant that's very different may actually have better results. So someone might run a clinical trial on that one and get good results, and then someone tries to reproduce it with the same plant, but it's a very different chemotype, and get different results. So, as you say, it's a very difficult area to research.
It is, absolutely. You mentioned chemotype, and that's the subtle difference in chemicals produced depending on the growing area, the soil, the daylight hours, the particular subspecies or hybrid of the plant, isn't it? And it almost becomes too much of a problem to cope with. But I think we're going to leave it as too much of a problem to cope with, because we've got so much we want to ask it, so much we want to get into. And we mentioned earlier the fact that you've travelled extensively throughout India, China, Japan. And I know that that's not just for herbalism and for your PhD, but you have an interest in all things.
Yeah, actually, I only went to Japan for kendo and the Aida.
For kendo, tell us about your kendo.
You went to Japan just for kendo.
Yeah, kendo and the Aida. I was taken.
Don't you know you can buy a kendo doll? That's the equivalent of Barbie, isn't it? You get a kendo.
Oh, no, not that's Ken. It's not
that's
kendo.
Kendo. That's kendas or kendo.
Ken do or Ken don't.
Sorry. Okay.
Ken does nothing. The boy does nothing.
Corrected.
So this is bashing people over the head with funny sticks. Ken knows.
Kendo is.
Oh, I better shut up. Then.
Is waving a Japanese samurai sword around and trying to cut things with it.
So this is where you get told up in all of the wooden armor.
In armor.
Mm. So this is sword fighting with big sticks.
Yeah, it's Japanese fencing, if you like. Yeah, Japanese style fencing.
How and why did you get into kendo?
Well, it was a kind of development from doing aikido, really, which was a development from doing kind of judo and jiu-jitsu. And it's just something I've been involved with for 35 years.
Don't you love the way Tony sort of mentions all these things? They're the natural segues. I've done this, yeah, I did a bit of that.
We've obviously hit something here, because you've just brushed over it, and you've just listed half a dozen Japanese martial arts, and you've just brushed over it. But I asked you how you got into it and why.
Oh, wow. I was working at the Wellcome Foundation, as we mentioned earlier.
Right.
And every Thursday night, everyone would go down to the Wellcome bar and drink lots of beer, because Wellcome were making lots of money and the share prices were going up and everyone was very happy.
Sounds reasonable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Big thing. And there was some crazy guy down there who decided he wanted to hit people over. Who wasn't in the company, just got into the club, and decided he wanted to hit someone over the head with a bottle. And I was about 25 years old, and he decided he was going to come and hit me. And just before he came over with this bottle, and I'm thinking, oh shit, someone's going to hit me. This guy who was working on the door just came along and put him in some kind of arm lock, took the bottle and like chucked him on the floor, and said, off you go now. And I thought, oh, that looked really good. We got chatting, and it turned out he was running the Aikido club in because there was all clubs for everything anyone wanted to do, and he was in charge of the Aikido club. So I joined up, and It kind of went on from there, and that was 1985.
So you got into Aikido having been rescued from a desperate situation by a master of Aikido.
Absolutely, yeah.
I can think of no better reason to get into it.
that's pretty much it, isn't it? That's
pretty inspirational, isn't it?
Inspiration.
Yeah.
And you've gone on from there. I have to say, viewers, listeners, that I've been privileged to have been hit over the head many, many times by Tony, using things ranging from his kendo practice sword all the way through from a brown trout, a halibut, a large cucumber, a marrow, and a small plastic chicken in the past. Each time I felt incredibly privileged and happy to be hit over the head by her professor doctor.
I can't wait till I see you next, Julian. This is awesome. So tell me, Tony, you should have just go up and go, hello, Julian. Whatever it is that you have in your hand.
We did a very nice Monty Python routine in Malta where we were recreating the slapping of the fish around the face and then slapping with the large salmon as Julian ended up in the swimming pool. I forgot he actually had a really serious neck problem at the time, so probably shouldn't hit him around the salmon quite as hard.
I had a slip disc in my neck, but I was fine. I couldn't use my right arm for about 6 months, but it was okay. It was all right.
You've forgiven him, have you, Julian?
Oh, I forgave him immediately because he bought me lots of Maltese wine.
Or have you forgiven him? Because if you don't forgiven him and try and hit him with a bottle, you know that you're going to get clapped around the ear with a stick or the bottle
It'll be something harder. I guess typically, I should say for Tony, you've gone into kendo, but haven't just dabbled, have you? Do you want to tell us what level you've got to with kendo?
Well, it's actually... you know, I've only been doing kendo about 15 years, which may not, I mean, that may not, you may think that's quite a long time. My kendo instructor, Okimitsu Fuji, who's from Japan, he was doing kendo for, before he died, he was doing kendo for 70 years. He started when he was 6 years old and he was doing kendo to 76. And the oldest person in Japan who's still competing in kendo, like in real fighting competitions, is 105 years old and has been doing kendo, you know, over 90 years. So,
wow.
We need to put it in some perspective. So doing it 15 years, I'm really very much a beginner.
Yeah, but he's always going to win, isn't he? You're never going to whack some 105-year-old around the head, are you? Okay, you won again, no, son. Well done.
You're not. You've won again.
You've won again.
I can't even get out of his chair. Doesn't matter. You've won. You've won.
Dumbo arigato. Tell you what, I'll take my hat off. Give it one there. Oh, yes, you win. Oh,
I could just about lose this. Oh, there we go.
What?
I'm guessing he can probably move, actually. We're saying this. Is he still doing all the moves he was doing when he was a sprightly 75-year-old?
Well, it's about, you don't need, you know, when you're in your 20s and 30s, you run around a lot and use lots of energy. When you get to, you know, you've been doing something 50 or 60 years, you discover it's probably more about timing. You don't actually need to move very much at all. With a kendo stick, you're recreating a real sword. It's not a, it shouldn't, although it is, sometimes a bit, it becomes a bit of a contact sport. It should be really focused on the sword and a good cut, and you know, the ability to do a good cut really depends on just reading the other person and doing something at the right time.
I saw Uma Thurman do it in that film, and she had really exquisite timing.
That's actually a very good example, and I particularly like the way when she took her sandals off, she actually moved them backwards, and then she took the other one off and moved it backwards. And so she didn't actually move backwards at all, which is actually a principle. One of the main principles of kendo is that you never go back, you always go forward.
Right. Is that right? Which was when I drove my 2CV, because I could never get it into reverse.
Yeah, but I want to know if there are any other things that we should be looking out for in Kill Bill Part 1 or Part 2 with Uma Thurman.
There are a few. We'll talk about those later, perhaps.
Okay.
So, we were chatting, Tony, the other day, because you teach kendo, and you are third Dan.
Third Dan, yeah. Which again is very, you know, people, you know, when I started martial arts, you know, I thought, you know, get to black belt, and you know, that's what you need to achieve, because that's what I saw from movies and everything like that. And back in the kind of 70s and 80s, that was the big focus. But when you actually get into it, you find that, you know, black belt is like the beginning stage. It's Shodan, and the characters for Shodan are a tailor cutting his cloth. So first Dan black belt means that the cloth has been cut correctly, and now we need to make a suit. So really, a black belt just means that you've gone through basic training and now you're ready to learn. And so I've got third Dan, but in Japan, you wouldn't be able to teach until you've reached fifth Dan. So we need to keep in some. So when someone says, you know, I've got a black belt, to me, that's not, you know, that impressive.
I've got a black belt, and if I turn the buckle over, it can turn into a brown belt.
Yeah, I've got one of those as well. It's brilliant. It's really nice. Yeah. I had to let it out a bit during lockdown.
Where's he going? For listeners, Tony just stood up and walked off. Oh, he's come back again.
Tony's disgusted at us, and he's sharpening his kendo sword.
We're going to get a virtual battering.
So we'll move on from kendo, I think, if that's all right, because you clearly are way out of our league on that. Your love.
Actually, I should just mention the professor I worked with, Jimmy Bell at Westminster, who's one of the world expert on mitochondrial health. He's also a fencer, a European fencer, quite high level. And so when we eventually go back, we've got an idea is we're going to have a contest of Japanese kendo fencing against Western fencing.
And, oh, well.
And see how that turns out.
So, Tony, you're going to fight a guy with a metal sharp sword with a piece of wood.
A bamboo stick. He's got a file or an epee, but I'll be dressed in the protective clothing of fencing, and he'll be dressed in the protective clothing of kendo. So it should work out okay.
Right.
Brilliant.
We digressed.
Yep. Well, let's bring us back on track then, Tony.
Yeah.
On Veterinary Ramblings, we've got a well established part of the show that we call 60-second CPD.
All right.
So, Herr Professor Dr. Professor Tony Booker, you want to talk about turmeric?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, Tony Booker, welcome to 60-second CPD. You have 60 seconds talking about turmeric starting now.
Hey, so turmeric is a very interesting herb. It's actually, the Latin name is Cucuma longa, although it does have a very closely related species, Cucuma aromatica, and they're only really differentiated by the number of curcuminoids that each one possesses. But the thing about turmeric is they're not all the same. Some contain a very high in essential oils, some are very high in curcuminoids, and so they're very different varieties. And people take them mainly for anti-inflammatory action. The main problem with turmeric is it's not very bioavailable, but you can increase the bioavailability through introducing piperine. And this was known a very long time ago because people took it with black pepper. By taking piperine, you actually increase the glucuronic acid conjugation in phase two liver metabolism, and your body is able to accept it a lot better.
Wow. And that was spot on. That was absolutely spot
Excellent.
On. So essentially you're saying, if you want to get the best out of the turmeric, put a bit of pepper in it.
Yeah, and if you notice, I mean, I don't want to brag, but since I did my PhD, post-Booker PhD, there were no products on the market with added pepper, pre-Booker PhD, but post-Booker PhD, nearly every turmeric product you Google on the internet has piperine added,
wow.
Or pepper added, and piperine is the... from either black pepper or long pepper is the main ingredient. And traditionally, people would add black pepper to the turmeric. And as I say, it does inhibit glucuronic acid conjugation. And so bioavailability, in theory, should be better, even though there's not really good evidence to show that that happens. But when you'll notice turmeric products, they're just full of either added pepper or But it's a good idea, you know, maybe why pepper was such a sought-after product, if it does have this effect of effectively increasing the bioavailability of of different foods.
And just to put it into some sort of perspective, you talk about glucuronic acid inhibition or glucuronidase inhibition, and our listeners will be thinking, yeah, so what the heck does that mean? Because cats don't produce glucuronidase, they die if they're given paracetamol. We have paracetamol and survive because we can produce it. So it's a huge metabolic difference there that we're seeing with a tiny tiny addition in this case of pepper, which, you know, with cats, you can't. Okay, so any listeners, don't give your cats paracetamol and pepper. That won't work. It will not work. They'll sneeze and they'll still die. But I'm just illustrating your point here. I just hope no one switched off before I said that and think, great, now I'm going to go out and give my cat some paracetamol and grind some pepper in because Julian said it's fine. And they'll have switched off and I think, oh my God, those cats have died already. It's too late for them. Don't do it. Please don't. But
don't give your cat paracetamol.
Yeah, okay, so that's the thing. Don't give your cat paracetamol.
Or humans.
No. Or humans. Don't give your cat humans.
Yeah, yeah. Do not feed your cat humans.
Do drink whiskey. Single malts are best. Alcohol. Now, some of our listeners may drink, and obviously we could never condone that because always drink responsibly is our motto. And although Mike and I pretend to have a drink on Veterinary Ramblings, it's always water or tea of some sort. Is there anything, speaking as a herbalist, that we can take to improve the health of our livers? And in all seriousness, don't overdrink and think, I'm going to take some pills because they'll get it better. But for general liver health, for general health, is there anything we can take?
There's a couple of interesting things there. I mean, one of the main kind of Western herbs is milk is milk thistle.
And that's psilocybin or something, isn't it?
It contains silymarins.
Silymarin.
Which kind of an aside, it's, you know, people talk about, you know, are herbal medicines effective? Milk thistle is the only, I think I've mentioned this to you before, it's the only antidote for poisoning by Amanita phalloides, the death cat mushroom.
Absolutely.
The only possible chance you have of living if you've taken too much of this is to take milk thistle.
Yeah.
And that's the good news. The bad news is it has to be within 24 hours and it has to be given intravenously. So in places like France, the pharmacies, you know, keep stocks of silymarin for silly English people who have been out to France picking mushrooms. We don't over here because, you know, people don't really do a lot of mushroom picking. But certainly milk thistle has got a good reputation for liver health. Turmeric is supposed to be liver protective. There's a mushroom in Taiwan called Entrodia camphorata. And when I was in Taiwan, everyone was taking this before going out for a drink because the Taiwanese lack a drink. Before we went out, people said, oh, take this. Were the drugs? this party.
But what they do is they take this world, isn't it?
They take it to protect the liver. And we've actually done some research on Westminster and shown it does have some effects on fatty liver as well. So it's quite an interesting plant. And again, I was at a conference and with lots of Korean people, and they wanted to do lots of gambaing, which is showing me the bottom of the glass. And I could tell I was starting to get a little bit tipsy, and someone said, I'll take this, and it's a mixture of different plants. And I took it, and I sobered right up. There certainly seems to be some interesting things out there.
So what are these prophylactic hangover cures?
Purely from interest.
I'm sure one of our listeners would be interested. Not me personally. No.
The German one in the little bottle?
What, the Jägermeister?
Isn't that herbal?
That's herbal.
That's herbal.
It must be, because herbal so is absinthe. Tastes awful generally, doesn't it?
Yeah, but so is absinthe, but neither are prophylactic hangover cures.
Mm. No, I don't know, but there's a kudzu, there's a plant used in Japan, kudzu root, which is, I think it's perilia, and that's used by alcoholics a lot, because if you take this plant, you'll get drunk more quickly, and so you actually drink less alcohol to get to the same effect.
And of course... Caprinus atramentarius, a type of ink cap, is used as a cure for alcoholism, because if you take that, then you'll feel sick every time you drink, and it's an aversion therapy, isn't it? So is that smooth ink cap? I can't remember. Caprinus atramentarius, I know, is the Latin name. I think it's smooth ink cap, isn't it?
Okay.
Caprinus comatus, of course, is shaggy in cap, which is my favourite shroom. Absolutely amazing. We've had a few of those over the years, because Mike, Tony and I have a history of mushroom foraging going back many years now. And had some wonderful times getting the most amazing mushrooms and... frying them up in the New Forest or places like that, all washed down with a few drinks. And do you know, I think that should be our farewell thought for tonight, that perhaps this autumn we should all meet up and do a bit of foraging. I'm well aware our listeners are going to be thinking, great, where do we go? No, you can't. It's just us. So sorry. I'm being mean. Traditionally, mushroom hunters don't give away their secrets. We don't tell you where the best mushrooms are. But here, I'm going to break some traditions, and I'm going to say the best place to get seps and shaggy ink caps in our area are and if you go there, you're bound to get some. If you can't find any there, then just round the road to the right and are the best. Really best places to get chanterelles. So
you seem to be glitching for a second.
I don't think so. No, I think everyone heard that. It's fine.
I think we've run out of money. I think we need to put another 50p in the meter or something.
Should we give our usual warning that all mushrooms are edible, some only once?
That's a good point, actually. Yes, if in doubt, leave it out. And we had an episode on mushroom foraging, Tony, a year ago with Georgie Hollis.
Yeah,
and we made the point there. Please, 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 if you are going to forage, then go with an expert. Join a group. Please do not eat any mushrooms that you are not 100% certain are the correct edible types.
And the same with alcohol. Ask only friends on Facebook.
Absolutely. Same with alcohol. Do not drink anything you're absolutely certain is going to taste nice. And I must say, I've got a bottle of Côte d'Aron here, and it's jolly nice. So I'm going to carry on drinking that.
But
I'm going to pop my glass up now, because I think the time has come to toast our guest for tonight.
Well, no, I don't think it is.
Hasn't
I think it is because Tony's delivered an amazing 60-second CPD.
Really good, really good. Yeah. I know what you're going to say.
Yeah. So have we got a certificate for all those people that will be presenting tonight's show as their CPD for the day?
We have. We've got a certificate. Here we go.
Oh, jolly good. What's the certificate then?
So it's a certificate. Certificate of polymathy. This certifies that more than one math has been presented tonight. And then says at the bottom, polymath, but single malt. and there's some pictures around here. So let's go through the pictures here. The top left here of this certificate is a picture of, and Tony's going to recognise this instantly, it's the Greek sea urchin, which we absolutely adore. It's delicious. The corals or... or roes from the sea urchin are my favourite food of all time. Fantastic. And just below that, there's a mushroom, Fasciola hepatica. Yeah, the beefsteak mushroom, which you have to cook in milk, don't you, to make the vegetable.
Yeah.
And below that, of course,
the porcini.
Porcini, which is the penny bun or sep or Belitis edulis. And next to that is a younger Tony doing a Karate Kid impression in Rackham Woods. And then we can really get on to this. We've got no time for tonight. We'll get on to it later. This is a bag collecting natural latex. And one of the things I was hoping to get on to was sustainability of rubber and latex and things like that. However, we move on. Here's a picture of a turmeric flower. They're gorgeous flowers. Absolutely beautiful flowers. And this is a plant I bought because I haven't been able to grow turmeric flowers. I've got turmeric roots. Here is her professor doctor reclining on his yacht and thinking hard on herbal medicine and a catch of fish that we were lucky enough to get last time we went fishing together. And I think all of that together shows what a wonderful night's CPD we've had and how many things we've covered. We mentioned polymaths a few times. I think we've been privileged tonight to have Tony, who is one of life's true polymaths. So,
absolutely. Absolutely. No, it's been a privilege, and I'm sure our listeners and viewers will share their views and their likes. And don't forget to click like, share, subscribe, whether you're watching us on YouTube, picking us up off iTunes, Apple, Spotify, or any of the other podcast download forums. And don't forget to join in on the chat on Facebook. And we look forward to hearing your views.
Good night, and may your dog go with you.
Tony Booker, thank you very, very much indeed. It's been an absolute privilege. May your dog go with you.
Thank you very much. It was great.
Thank you.
Cheers.